Darkness had fallen before they reached Sydney, but the TV mast stood like a massive light bulb in the center of the town and showed them the way. Andrew drew in at Circular Quay, not far from the Opera House. A bat whirled in and out of the car headlights at great speed. Andrew lit a cigar and motioned for Harry to remain in the car.
"The bat is the Aboriginal symbol of death. Did you know that?"
Harry did not. "Imagine a place where people have been isolated for 40,000 years. In other words, they haven't experienced Judaism, never mind Christianity and Islam, because a whole ocean has separated them from the closest continent. Nevertheless, they come up with their own history of creation, the dreaming. The first man was Beardrook Bourne. He was made by Baami, the uncreated, who was the beginning of everything, and who loved and took care of all living things. In other words, a good man, this Baami. Friends called him the Great Fatherly Spirit. After Baami established Beardrook Bourne and his wife in a good place, he left his mark on a sacred tree, Yarran, nearby, which was the home of a swarm of bees. You can take food from anywhere you want in the whole of this country that I have given you, but this is my tree, he warned the two people. If you try to take food from there, much evil will befall you, and those who come after you. Something like that. At any rate, one day Beardrook Bourne's wife was collecting wood, and she came to the Yarran tree. At first she was frightened at the sight of the holy tree towering above her, but there was so much wood lying around that she did not follow her first impulse, which was to run away as fast as her legs could carry her. Besides, Baami had not said anything about wood. While she was gathering the wood around the tree, she heard a low buzzing sound above her head, and she gazed up at the swarm of bees. She also saw the honey running down the trunk. She had only tasted honey once before, but here there was enough for several meals. The sun glistened on the sweet, shiny drops, and in the end, Beardrook Bourne's wife could not resist the temptation, and she climbed up the tree. At that moment, a cold wind came from above, and a sinister figure with enormous black wings enveloped her. It was Naradan the Bat, whom Baami had entrusted with guarding the holy tree. The woman fell to the ground and ran back to a cave where she hid, but it was too late. She had released death into the world, symbolized by the bat, Naradan, and all of the Beardrook-born descendants would be exposed to its curse. The Yarran tree cried bitter tears over the tragedy that had taken place. The tears ran down the trunk and thickened, and that is why you can find red rubber on the bark of the tree nowadays. Andrew puffed happily on his cigar. Gives Adam and Eve a run for their money, doesn't it? Harry nodded and conceded there were a number of parallels. Perhaps it's just that people, wherever they live on the globe, somehow share the same visions or fantasies. It's in our nature, wired into the hard drive, so to speak. Despite all the differences, sooner or later we still come up with the same answers.
Let's hope so, Andrew said.
He squinted through the smoke.
Let's hope so.
9. A sea nettle jellyfish. Harry was well down his second coke when Birgitta arrived at 9:10. She was wearing a plain white cotton dress, and her red hair was collected in an impressive ponytail. I was beginning to worry you wouldn't come, Harry said. It was said as a joke, but he meant it. He had started worrying the moment they agreed to meet.
Really?
She said in Swedish. She sent Harry a mischievous look. He had a feeling this was going to be a great evening. They ordered Thai green curry with pork, chicken with cashew nuts cooked in a wok, an Australian Chardonnay and Perrier water. I must say I'm pretty surprised to meet a Swede so far from home.
You shouldn't be. There are about 90,000 Swedes in Australia.
What?
Most immigrated here before the Second World War, but quite a lot of young people left in the 80s, with unemployment on the rise in Sweden.
And there was me thinking Swedes would be missing their meatballs and the midsummer dancing before they reached Helsingør.
That must be Norwegians you were thinking about. You're crazy, you lot. The Norwegians I've met here started yearning for home after a few days, and after 2 months they were back in Norway. Back home to woolly cardigans.
But not Inga.
Birgitta fell quiet. No, not Inger.
Do you know why she stayed here?
Probably the same reason as for most of us. You go on holiday, fall in love with the country, the climate, the easy lifestyle, or a man. You apply to have your permit extended. Scandinavian girls don't exactly have a problem getting jobs in bars. And suddenly it's such a long way home, and it's so simple to stay. Is that how it was for you too? More or less. They ate in silence for a while. The curry was thick, strong, and good. What do you know about Inga's last boyfriend? As I said, he popped by the bar one night. She'd met him in Queensland, on Fraser Island, I think it was. He looked like the version of hippie I thought had died out long ago, but is alive and well here in Australia. Long braided hair, colourful baggy clothes, sandals, like he'd walked in off Woodstock Beach. Woodstock's inland, New York. But wasn't there a lake they swam in? I seem to remember that. Harry ran a closer eye over her. She was sitting hunched over her food, concentrating. The freckles were bunched in a cluster over her nose. She was pretty. That was Harry's opinion. You shouldn't know that kind of thing. You're too young. She laughed. And what are you? Past it? Me? Well, some days I might be. It comes with the job. Somewhere inside, you age all too quickly. But I hope I'm not so disillusioned and jaded that I can't feel alive now and then. Oh, poor you. Harry had to smile. You can think what you like, but I'm not saying that to appeal to your maternal instinct, even though that might not have been a bad idea. It's just the way it is. The waiter passed the table and Harry took the opportunity to order another bottle of water. You're a tiny bit damaged every time you unravel another murder case. Unfortunately, as a rule, there are more human wrecks and sadder stories and fewer ingenious motives than you would imagine from reading Agatha Christie. At first I saw myself as a kind of knight, dispensing justice, but at times I feel more like a refuse collector. Murderers are generally pitiful sorts, and it's seldom difficult to point to at least 10 good reasons why they turned out as they did. So, usually, what you feel most is frustration. Frustration that they can't be happy destroying their own lives, instead of dragging others down with them. This probably still sounds a touch sentimental. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to appear cynical. I understand what you mean, she said. A gentle breeze from the street caused the flame of the candle on the table to flicker. Birgitta told Harry about how she and her boyfriend had packed their rucksacks in Sweden 4 years ago and set off, how they had travelled by bus and hitched from Sydney to Cairns, slept under canvas and in backpacker hotels, worked there as receptionists and cooks, dived by the Great Barrier Reef, and swam side by side with turtles and hammerhead sharks. They had meditated on Uluru, saved their money to catch the train from Adelaide to Alice Springs, been to a Crowded House concert in Melbourne, and hit the wall in a motel in Sydney. It's strange how something that works so well can be so wrong. Wrong. Birgitta hesitated. Perhaps she was thinking she'd said too much to this rather direct Norwegian. I don't really know how to explain it. We lost something on the way that had been there, and we'd taken for granted. We stopped looking at each other, and soon we stopped touching each other. We came to be no more than travelling companions, someone it was good to have around because double rooms were cheaper and tents safer with two. He met a rich man's daughter, German, in Nusa, and I kept on travelling so that he could continue the affair in peace. I didn't give a shit. When he arrived in Sydney, I told him I'd fallen in love with an American surf freak I'd just met. I don't know if he believed me. Perhaps he understood that I was giving both of us a pretext for finishing things. We tried to argue in the motel room in Sydney, but we couldn't even do that anymore. So I told him to go back to Sweden first, and I would follow. He would have quite a head start on you now. We were together for 6 years. Would you believe me if I said I can hardly remember what he looked like? I would. Birgitta sighed. I didn't think it would be like that. I was sure we would get married and have children and live in a little suburb of Malmö with a garden and Sydsvenska Dagbladet on the doorstep. And now? Now I can hardly remember the sound of his voice or what it was like to make love with him or... She looked up at Harry, or how he was too polite to tell me to shut up while I was babbling on after a couple of glasses of wine. Harry grinned. She hadn't commented on the fact that he hadn't drunk any of the wine. I'm not polite. I'm interested, he said, In that case, you'll have to tell me something personal about you, other than that you're a policeman.
Birgitta leaned across the table. Harry told himself not to look down her dress. He sensed her aroma and greedily breathed in the fragrance. He must not let himself be duped. Those cunning bastards at Karl Lagerfeld and Christian Dior knew exactly what was required to trap a poor man. She smelled wonderful. "Well," Harry began, "I have a sister. My mother died. I live in a flat I can't get rid of in Tøyen, Oslo. I have no lengthy relationships behind me, and only one has left any marks."
"Really? And there's no one in your life now?"
"Not really. I have a few uncomplicated, meaningless relationships with women I occasionally ring if they don't ring me."
Birgitta frowned. "Something wrong? I'm not sure if I approve of that kind of men, or woman. I'm a bit old-fashioned like this."
"Of course, I've put all that stuff behind me," Harry said, raising the glass of Perrier. "And I'm not sure I like these glib answers of yours either," Birgitta said, raising her glass. "So what do you look for in a man?" She rested her chin on her hand and gazed into the air, considering the question.
"I don't know. I think I know more about what I don't like in a man than what I do."
"What don't you like, apart from glib answers? Men who try to check me out. Do you suffer a lot?" She smiled.
"Let me give you a tip, Casanova. If you want to charm a woman, you have to make her feel unique. Make her feel she's being given special treatment, something no one else gets. Men who try to pick up girls in bars don't understand it. But I suppose that means nothing to a libertine like you."
Harry laughed. "By a few, I mean two. I said a few because that sounds a bit wilder. It sounds like three. One, by the way, is on her way back to her ex, according to what she told me the last time I saw her. She thanked me because I had been so uncomplicated, and the relationship had been so, well, meaningless, I assume. The other is a woman I started a relationship with, and who now insists that since it was me who left, it is my duty to ensure that she has a modicum of a sex life until either of us finds someone else. Hang on. Why have I gone all defensive here? I'm a normal man who wouldn't harm a flea. Are you implying that I'm trying to charm someone?"
"Oh, yes. You're trying to charm me. Don't deny it."
Harry didn't deny it. "All right. How am I doing?" She took a long swig from her wine glass and gave the matter some thought.
"B, I reckon. Moderate, anyway. No, I think it will have to be a B. You're doing quite well."
"Sounds like B minus.
There or thereabouts."
It was dark down by the harbour, almost deserted, and a fresh wind had sprung up. On the steps to the illuminated opera house, an unusually overweight bride and groom posed for the photographer. He directed them hither and thither, and the newlyweds seemed to be very annoyed at having to move their large bodies. In the end, though, they came to an agreement, and the nocturnal photo session in front of the opera house ended in smiles, laughter, and perhaps a little tear.
"That's what they must mean by bursting with happiness," Harry said.
"Or perhaps you don't say that in Swedish."
"Yes, we do. You could be so happy you burst in Swedish, too."
Birgitta took off her hairband and stood in the wind by the harbour railing, facing the opera house.
"Yes, you could," she repeated, as if to herself.
She turned her freckled nose to the sea, and the wind blew her red hair back. She looked like a sea nettle jellyfish. He didn't know a jellyfish could be so beautiful. 10. A town called Nimbin. Harry's watch showed 11 as the plane landed in Brisbane, but the stewardess on the speaker insisted it was only 10.
"They don't have summer time in Queensland," Andrew informed him. "It was a big political issue up here, culminating in a referendum, and the farmers voted against it."
"Wow. Sounds like we've come to redneck country."
"I reckon so, mate. Up until a few years ago, long-haired men were refused entry to the state. It was banned outright."
"You're joking."
"Queensland's a bit different. Soon they'll probably ban skinheads."
Harry stroked his close-cropped skull. "Anything else I ought to know about Queensland?"
"Well, if you've got any marijuana in your pockets, you'd better leave it on the plane. In Queensland, the drugs laws are stricter than in other states.
It was no coincidence that the Aquarius Festival was held in Nimbin, the town's just over the border in New South Wales. They found the Avis office where they had been told a car would be ready and waiting for them. On the other hand, Queensland has places like Fraser Island, where Inga Holter met Evans White. The island's actually no more than a huge sandbank, but on it you can find a rainforest and lakes with the world's clearest water and sand that is so white the beaches look as if they've been made out of marble. Silicon sand, it's called, because the silicon content's so much higher than in normal sand. You can probably pour it straight into a computer. The land of plenty, eh? Said the guy behind the counter, passing them a key. Ford Escort. Andrew wrinkled his nose, but signed. Is it still going? Special rate, sir. Don't doubt it. The sun was frying the Pacific Highway, and Brisbane's skyline of glass and stone glittered like crystals on a chandelier as they approached. From the freeway eastward, they drove through rolling green countryside alternating between forest and cultivated field. Welcome to the Australian outback, Andrew said. They passed cows, grazing with lethargic stares. Harry chuckled. What's up? Andrew asked. Have you seen the comic strip by Larson, where the cows are standing on two legs chatting in the meadow, and one of them warns, Car! Silence. Who's Larson? Never mind. They passed low wooden houses with verandas at the front, mosquito nets in the doorways, and pickup trucks outside. They drove past broad-backed workhorses, watching them with melancholy eyes, beehives and penned pigs blissfully rolling in the mud. The roads became narrower. Around lunchtime they stopped for petrol in a little settlement a sign informed them was called Uki, which had been chosen as Australia's cleanest town for 2 years running. It didn't say who had won last year. Holy macaroni, Harry said as they trundled into Nimbin. The town centre was about 100 metres in length, painted all colours of the rainbow, with a crop of characters that could have come from one of the Cheech and Chong films in Harry's video collection. We're back in 1970, he exclaimed. I mean, look over there. Peter Fonda in a clinch with Janis Joplin. They slowly cruised down the street as somnambulist eyes followed them. This is great. I didn't think places like this existed anymore. You could just die laughing. Why? Andrew asked. Don't you think it's funny? Funny? I can see it's easy to laugh at these dreamers nowadays. I can see that the new generation thinks the Flower Power lot were a bunch of potheads with nothing else to do except play guitars, read their poems, and screw one another as the whim took them. I can see that the organisers of Woodstock turn up for interviews wearing ties and talk with amusement about the ideas of those times, which obviously seem very naive to them now. But I can also see that the world would have been a very different place without the ideals that generation stood for. Slogans like peace and love may be clichés now, but back then we meant it, with all our hearts. Aren't you a bit old to have been a hippie, Andrew? Yes, I was old. I was a veteran hippie, a slyboots, Andrew grinned. Many a young girl received her first introduction into the intricate mysteries of lovemaking with Uncle Andrew. Harry patted him on the shoulder. I thought you were just talking about idealism, you old goat. Of course, this was idealism, Andrew said with indignation. I couldn't leave these fragile flower buds to some awkward, pimply teenager and risk the girl being traumatized for the rest of the 70s. Andrew glanced out of the car window and chuckled. A man with long hair, a beard, and a tunic was sitting on a bench and making the peace sign with two raised fingers. A placard with a drawing of an old yellow VW camper announced the Marijuana Museum. Beneath, in smaller letters, admission $1. If you can't pay, come in anyway. This is Nimbin's dope museum, Andrew explained. It's mostly crap. But I seem to remember they have some interesting photos of the Mexico trips with Ken Kesey, Jack Kerouac, and the other pioneers, when they were experimenting with consciousness-expending drugs. When LSD wasn't dangerous, and sex was just healthy. Wonderful times, Harry Howley. You should have been there, men. They parked further up the main street and walked back. Harry took off his Ray-Bans and tried to look like a civilian. It was clearly a quiet day in Nimbin, and Harry and Andrew ran the gauntlet between the vendors. Good grass. Best grass in Australia, men. Grass from Papua New Guinea. Mind-blowing. Papua New Guinea,
Andrew snorted. Even here in the grass capital, people walk around thinking grass is better if it comes from somewhere far enough away. By Australian, I say. A pregnant yet thin girl was sitting on a chair in front of the museum and waved to them. She could have been anything from 20 to 40, and was wearing a loose, vivid skirt and a buttoned-up blouse, making her stomach stand out with the skin stretched like a drum. There was something vaguely familiar about her, Harry thought, and from the size of her pupils, Harry was able to conclude there had been something more stimulating than marijuana on her breakfast menu that day. "Looking for something else?" she asked. She had observed that they hadn't shown any interest in buying marijuana. "No," Harry started to say. "Acid? You want LSD, don't you?" She leaned forward and spoke with urgency and passion.
"No, we don't want any acid," Andrew said in a low, firm voice. "We're looking for something else. Understand?"
She sat, gazing at them. Andrew made a move to go on, but then she jumped up, apparently unaffected by the large stomach, and took his arm.
"Okay, but we can't do that here. You'll have to meet me in the pub over there in 10 minutes.
Andrew nodded, and she turned and hurried down the street with her large bump, a small puppy running at her heels.
"I know what you're thinking, Harry," Andrew said, lighting up a cigar. "It wasn't nice to trick Mother Kindheart into believing we would buy some heroin. The police station's 100 metres up the street, and we could find what we need on Evans White there. But I have a hunch this'll be quicker. Let's go and have a beer and see what happens."
Half an hour later, Mother Kindheart entered the near-empty pub, with a man who seemed at least as hunted as she was. He resembled the Klaus Kinski version of Count Dracula, pale, lean, dressed in black with dark bags under his eyes.
"There you go,"
Andrew whispered. "You can hardly accuse him of not testing the stuff he sells." Mother Kindheart and the Kinski clone made straight for them. The latter did not appear to want to spend any more time in daylight than was absolutely necessary, and skipped the small talk.
"How much?"
Andrew sat demonstratively with his back to them.
"I prefer there to be as few people present as possible before we get down to brass tacks, mister,"
he said without turning. Kinski tossed his head, and Mother Kindheart left with a peeved expression. She probably worked on a percentage basis, and Harry assumed the trust between her and Kinski was, as it always was with junkies, non-existent.
"I've got nothing on me, and if you're cops, I'll cut your balls off. Show me the Brit first, then we can get out of here."
He spoke fast. He was nervous, and his eyes jumped about.
"Is it far?"
Andrew asked. "It's a short walk, but a long trip." What was meant to be a smile was a brief glimpse of teeth before it was gone.
"Good on you, mate. Sit down and shut up,"
Andrew said, showing him his police badge. Kinski froze. Harry stood up and patted the back of his belt. There was no reason to check whether Harry really had a weapon.
"What is this amateur dramatic stuff? I've got nothing on me. I told you, didn't I?"
He slumped defiantly into the chair opposite Andrew.
"I take it you know the local sheriff and his assistant, and they probably know you. But do they know you've started selling horse?"
The man shrugged.
"Who said anything about horse? I thought it was grass we..."
"Of course. No one said anything about junk, and it's unlikely anyone will, so long as you give us some information."
"You're kidding, aren't you? Would I risk being beheaded for snitching, just because 2 out-of-town cops who don't even have anything on me come bursting in and..."
"Snitching? We met here, and fortunately couldn't agree on the price of the goods, and that was that. You've even got a witness that we met here on normal business. Do as we tell you, and you'll never see us again, and nor will anyone else here."
Andrew lit a cigar, peered through narrow slits at the poor junkie on the other side of the table, blew smoke into his face, and continued.
"Should we not get what we're after, however, we might put on our badges when we leave here and perform a couple of arrests, which wouldn't exactly increase your popularity in the local community. I don't know if cutting the balls off snitches is used up here. After all, potheads are peaceful folk as a rule, but they know the odd trick or two, and it wouldn't surprise me if, right out of the blue, the sheriff didn't stumble across your whole stock, quite by chance. Potheads aren't so happy about competition from the hard stuff, you know, at least not from junkies, snitches. And I'm sure you know all about the penalties for dealing in large quantities of heroin, don't you?"
More blue cigar smoke in Kinski's face. It's not every day you have the chance to blow smoke into an asshole's face, Harry thought.
"Okay,"
Andrew said after no reply was forthcoming.
Evans White. Tell us where he is, who he is, and how we can get hold of him. Now.
Kinski looked around, his large hollow-cheeked skull turned on the thin neck, making him look like a vulture hovering over some carcass, checking anxiously to see if the lions were returning.
That all?
He asked. Nothing else?
Nothing else,
Andrew said. And how do I know you won't be back asking for more?
You don't.
He nodded as though he had known it was the only answer he would get.
Okay. He's no big fish yet, but from what I've heard, he's on the way up. He's worked for Madame Rousseau, the grass queen up here, but now he's trying to set up his own business. Grass, acid, and perhaps a bit of morphine. The grass is the same as the rest that's sold here, local production, but he must have connections in Sydney and delivers grass there in exchange for good, cheap acid. Acid's what it's all about now.
Where can we get hold of Evans?
Andrew asked. He's in Sydney quite a bit, but I saw him in town a couple of days ago. He's got a kid with a chick from Brisbane who used to hang out here. I don't know where she is now, but the kid's definitely in the block of flats where he lives when he's in Nimbin. He explained where the block was.
What sort of fella is White?
Andrew pressed. What can I say? He scratched the beard he didn't have. A charming asshole, isn't that what they're called? Andrew and Harry didn't know if that was what they were called, but nodded anyway. He's straight enough to deal with, but I wouldn't want to be his girl, if you know what I mean. They shook their heads to say they didn't know what he meant. He's a playboy, not exactly known for making do with one chick at a time. There are always arguments with his women. They scream and shout. So it's not unusual for one of them to sport a shiner once in a while.
Hmm. Do you know anything about a blonde-haired Norwegian girl called Inga Holter? She was found murdered by Watson's Bay in Sydney last week.
Really? Never heard of her. He clearly wasn't an avid newspaper reader either. Andrew stubbed out his cigar, and he and Harry got up.
Can I rely on you keeping your trap shut?
Kinski asked with a doubtful glare.
Of course,
Andrew said, striding toward the door.
What was the meal with their Swedish witness like?
Andrew asked after they had made a courtesy stop at the police station, a building that looked like any other house on the street, except for a little sign on the lawn announcing its purpose.
Good. Quite spicy, but good,
Harry answered pertly.
Come on, Harry. What did you talk about?
Lots.
Norway and Sweden.
I see.
Who won?
She did.
What's Sweden got that Norway hasn't?
Andrew asked. First things first. A couple of good film directors.
Bo Widerberg, Ingmar Bergman.
Ah, film directors, Andrew snorted. We've got them too. Edvard Grieg, on the other hand, is one of yours.
Wow, Harry said. I didn't know you were a connoisseur of classical music, in addition.
Grieg was a genius. Take, for example, the second movement of the Symphony in C minor where...
Sorry, Andrew, Harry said. I grew up with two-chord punk, and the closest I've been to a symphony is Yes and King Crimson. I don't listen to music from previous centuries, okay? Everything before 1980 is Stone Age. We have a band called the Dum Dum Boys who...
The C minor symphony was first performed in 1981,
Andrew said.
Dum Dum Boys. That's a very pretentious moniker.
Harry gave up and learned about Grieg all the way to the White residence. 11. A dealer. Evans White regarded them through half-open eyes. Strands of hair hung over his face. He scratched his groin and belched deliberately. He didn't seem at all surprised to see them. Not because he was expecting them, but probably because he didn't think visits were anything special. After all, he was sitting on the region's best acid, and Nimbin was a small place where rumors traveled fast. Harry imagined that a man like White did not bother with tiny amounts, and certainly not from his home, but that was hardly likely to deter people from showing up for the odd wholesale purchase.
You've come to the wrong place. Tryon Town, he said, closing the screen door. We're from the police, Mr. White.
Andrew held up his badge.
We'd like to talk to you.
Evans turned his back on them. Not today. I don't like cops. Come another time with an arrest warrant, a search warrant, or whatever. Then we'll see what we can do for you. Until then, goodbye. He slammed the inner door as well. Harry leaned against the doorframe and shouted,
Evans White, can you hear me? We are wondering whether this is you in the photo, sir, and if so, whether you knew the blonde woman sitting beside you. Her name's Inga Holter. She's dead now.
Silence for a while. Then the door hinges creaked. Evans peered out. Harry placed the photo against the netting. She didn't look so good when Sydney police found her, Mr. White.
In the kitchen, newspapers were scattered across the worktop. The sink was overflowing with plates and glasses, and the floor had not seen soapy water for a few months. Nevertheless, Harry could see at a glance that the place did not show any signs of real decay, and that it wasn't the home of a junkie on his uppers. There were no week-old leftovers, there was no mould, there was no stink of piss, and the curtains weren't drawn. Furthermore, there was a kind of basic order in the room which made Harry realize Evans White still had a grip on things. They found themselves chairs, and Evans fetched a stubby from the fridge which he put straight to his mouth. The belch resounded round the kitchen and was followed by a contented chuckle from Evans. "Tell us about your relationship with Inga Holter, Mr. White," Harry said, waving away the smell of the belch. "Inga was a nice, attractive and very stupid girl with some notion that she and I could be happy together." Evans studied the ceiling. Then he sniggered contentedly again. "I think, in fact, that sums it up very neatly. Have you any idea how she could have been killed, or who could have done it?" "Yes, we have newspapers up in Nimbin too, so I know she was strangled. But who did it?" "A strangler, I suppose." He threw his head back and grinned. A curl fell over his brow. His white teeth glistened in the tanned face, and the laughter lines around his brown eyes stretched back toward ears hung with pirate rings. Andrew cleared his throat. "Mr. White, a woman whom you knew well and with whom you had an intimate relationship has just been murdered. What you might or might not feel about that is not our business. However, as you are no doubt aware, we are looking for a murderer, and unless you try to help us this very minute, we will be forced to have you taken to the police station in Sydney."
"I'm going to Sydney anyway, so if that means you'll pay for my plane ticket, fine by me."
Harry didn't know what to think. Was Evans White as tough as he was trying to make out, or was he suffering from deficient mental faculties? Or an inadequately developed soul, a typically Norwegian concept? Harry wondered. Did courts anywhere else in the world judge the quality of a soul?
"As you wish, Mr. White,"
Andrew said. "Plane ticket, free board and lodging, free solicitor, and free PR as a murder suspect.
Big deal. I'll be out again within 48 hours.
And then we'll offer you a round-the-clock tail, a free wake-up service, maybe even the odd free raid thrown in as well. And who knows what else we can cook up."
Evans knocked back the rest of the beer and sat fiddling with the label on the bottle.
"What do you gentlemen want?" he said. "All I know is that one day she was suddenly gone. I was going to Sydney, so I tried to ring her, but she wasn't at work or at home. The day I arrive in Sydney, I read in the newspaper she's been found murdered. I walk around like a zombie for 2 days. I mean to say, murdered. What are the statistical chances of ending your life being throttled to death, eh?"
"Not high. But have you got an alibi for the time of the murder? It'd be good," Andrew said, taking notes. Evans started with horror.
"Alibi? What do you mean?
Surely you can't suspect me, for Christ's sake. Or are you telling me the cops have been on the case for a week and still don't have any real leads?"
"We're looking at all the evidence, Mr. White. Can you tell me where you were for the 2 days before you arrived in Sydney?"
"I was here, of course."
"Alone?"
"Not completely."
Evans grinned and chucked the empty stubby. It flew through the air in an elegant parabola before landing noiselessly in the rubbish bin by the worktop. Harry nodded acknowledgement.
"May I ask who was with you?"
"You already have, but fine. I've nothing to hide. It was a woman called Angelina Hutchinson. She lives in the town here."
Harry noted that down.
"Lover?"
Andrew asked.
"Sort of," Evans answered.
"What can you tell us about Inga Holter? Who was she?"
"Ah, we hadn't known each other for that bloody long. I met her on Fraser Island. She said she was headed down to Byron Bay. It's not far from here, so I gave her my phone number in Nimbin. A few days later, she rang me and asked if she could stop over one night. She was here for more than a week. After that, we met in Sydney when I was there. That must have been 2 or 3 times. As you know, we didn't exactly become an old married couple. And besides, she was already beginning to be a drag.
A drag?
Yes, she had a soft spot for my son, Tom-Tom, and let her imagination run away about a family and a house in the country. That didn't suit me, but I let her jabber on.
Jabber on about what?
Evan squirmed. She was the kind that's hard-faced when you meet her, but she's as soft as butter if you tickle her under the chin and tell her you love her. Then she can't do enough for you.
So she was a considerate young lady.
Evans clearly didn't like the path this conversation was following. Maybe she was. I didn't know her that well, as I said. She hadn't seen her family in Norway for a while, had she? So maybe she was starved for affection. Someone being there for her. Know what I mean? Who bloody knows? As I said, she was a stupid, romantic chick. There was no evil in her. Evans's voice faltered. The kitchen fell silent. Either he's a good actor or he does have human emotions after all, Harry thought.
If you didn't see any future in the relationship, why didn't you split up with her?
I was already on my way, standing in the doorway about to say bye, sort of, but she was gone before I could do anything. Just like that. He snapped his fingers. Yes, his voice has thickened, no doubt about it, Harry thought. Evans gazed down at his hands.
Quite a way to depart, wasn't it?
12. Quite a big spider. They drove up steep mountain roads. A signpost indicated the way to the Crystal Castle.
The question is Evans White telling the truth? Harry said. Andrew avoided an oncoming tractor.
Let me share a crumb of my experience with you, Harry. For over 20 years, I've been talking to people with a variety of reasons for lying or telling the truth. Guilty and innocent, murderers and pickpockets, bundles of nerves and cold fish, blue-eyed baby faces, scarred villain faces, sociopaths, psychopaths, philanthropists.
He searched for more examples. Point taken, Andrew.
Aboriginals and whites. They've all told their stories with one objective, to be believed. And do you know what I've learned?
That it's impossible to say who's lying and who isn't?
Exactly, Harry.
Andrew began to warm to the topic.
In traditional crime fiction, every detective with any self-respect has an unfailing nose for when people are lying. It's bullshit. Human nature is a vast, impenetrable forest, which no one can know in its entirety. Not even a mother knows her child's deepest secrets.
They turned into a car park in front of a large green garden, with a narrow gravel path winding between a fountain, flower beds, and exotic species of tree. A huge house presided over the garden and was obviously the Crystal Castle that the Nimbin sheriff had pointed out to them on a map. A bell above the door announced their arrival. This was clearly a popular place, for the shop was packed with tourists. An energetic woman greeted them with a radiant smile and welcomed them with such enthusiasm it was as if they were the first people she had seen here in months.
"Is this your first time here?"
she asked, as though her crystal shop were a habit-forming affair people flocked to regularly once they had been hooked. And for all they knew, that is exactly how it might have been.
"I envy you,"
she said after they confirmed it was.
"You're about to experience the Crystal Castle for the first time. Take that corridor there. On the right is our wonderful vegetarian cafe with the most exquisite meals. After you've been there, go left, into the crystal and mineral room. That's where the real action is. Now go, go, go."
She waved them off. After such a build-up, naturally it was an anticlimax to discover that the cafe was basically a standard outlet selling coffee, tea, lettuce with yogurt and lettuce sandwiches. In the designated crystal and mineral room, there was an exhibition of glittering crystals, Buddha figures with crossed legs, blue and green quartz and uncut stones in an elaborate light display. The room was filled with a faint aroma of incense, soporific panpipe music, and the sound of running water. Harry considered the shop nice enough, though a touch camp, and unlikely to take your breath away. What might cause respiratory difficulties, however, were the prices. Andrew laughed on seeing some of the price tags.
The woman's a genius.
He pointed to the generally middle-aged and evidently well-off customers in the shop.
The flower power generation has grown up. They have adult jobs, adult incomes, but their hearts are somewhere on an astral planet.
They walked back to the counter.
The energetic woman was still wearing her radiant smile. She took Harry's hand and pressed a blue-green stone in his palm.
You're Capricorn, aren't you? Put this stone under your pillow. It will remove all the negative energy in the room. It costs $65, but you really should have it, I think. So, let's say 50.
She turned to Andrew.
And you must be a Leo?
Oh, no, ma'am. I'm a policeman.
He discreetly held up his badge. She blanched and stared at him in horror.
How awful. I hope I haven't done anything wrong.
Not as far as I know, ma'am. I presume you're Margaret Dawson, formerly White. If so, may we have a word with you in private?
Margaret Dawson quickly pulled herself together and called one of the girls to take charge of the till. Then she accompanied Andrew and Harry to the garden, where they sat around a white wooden table. A net was stretched out between two trees. At first Harry thought it was a fishing net, but upon closer inspection it proved to be an enormous spider's web.
"Looks like rain," she said, rubbing her hands.
Andrew cleared his throat. She bit her lower lip.
"I'm sorry, officer. This makes me so nervous."
"That's okay, ma'am. Quite a web you've got there."
"Oh, that? That's Billy's, a mass spider. He's probably asleep somewhere."
Harry unconsciously tucked his legs under him. "Mouse spider. Does that mean it eats mice?" he asked. Andrew smiled.
"Harry's from Norway. They aren't used to big spiders."
"Oh, well, I can put your mind at rest. The big ones aren't dangerous," Margaret Dawson said. "However, we do have a lethal little creature called a redback. It likes towns best, though, where it can hide in the crowd, so to speak, in dark cellars and damp corners."
"Sounds like someone I know," Andrew said. "But back to business, ma'am. Your son."
Now Mrs. Dawson really did blanch.
"Evans?"
Andrew eyed Harry. "To our knowledge, he hasn't been in trouble with the police before, Mrs. Dawson," Harry said.
"No, no, he hasn't, thank God."
"We actually drove by because your place was on our route back to Brisbane. We were wondering if you knew anything about an Inga Holter." She ran the name through her memory. Then she shook her head.
"Evans doesn't know a lot of girls. The ones he does know, he brings here to meet me. After having a child with this terrible girl whose name I'm not sure if I want to remember, I thought he should wait a bit, until the right one came along."
"Why should he wait?" Harry asked.
"Because I said so."
"Why did you say so, ma'am?"
Because it's not the right moment."
She glanced at the shop to signal that her time was precious.
"And because Evans is a sensitive boy who can be easily hurt. There's been a lot of negative energy in his life, and he needs a woman he can trust 100%, not these tarts that just muddle his thinking."
Grey cloud cover had settled over her pupils.
"Do you see your son often?"
Andrew asked.
"Evans comes here as much as he can. He needs the peace. He works so hard, poor thing. Have you tried any of the herbs he sells? Now and then he brings a few along and I put them in the tea in the cafe."
Andrew cleared his throat again. From the corner of his eye, Harry noticed a movement between the trees.
"We'd better be off, ma'am. One last question, though."
"Yes?"
Andrew seemed to have something stuck in his throat. He kept coughing and coughing. The web had started to sway.
"Have you always had such blonde hair, Mrs. Dawson?"
13. Berber. It was late when they landed in Sydney. Harry was dead on his feet and longing for his hotel bed.
"A drink?" Andrew suggested.
"Don't you need to get home?" Harry asked.
Andrew shook his head. "I won't meet anyone there except myself at the moment."
"At the moment?"
"Well, for the last 10 years. I'm divorced. Wife lives in Newcastle with the girls. I try to see them as often as I can, but it's quite a distance, and the girls will soon be big enough to have their own plans for the weekend. Then I'll discover, I suppose, that I'm not the only man in their lives. They're good-looking little devils, you see. 14 and 15. Shit, I should chase away every admirer that darkens the door."
Andrew beamed. Harry couldn't help but like this unaccustomed version of a colleague.
"Well, that's the way it goes, Andrew."
"That's right, mate. How about you?"
"Well, no wife, no children, no dog. All I have is a boss, a sister, a father, and a couple of guys I still call pals, even though years pass between their calls. Or mine."
"In that order?"
"In that order."
They laughed.
"Camphor one at the Albury?"
That sounds like work, Harry said.
Precisely.
Birgitta smiled as they entered. She finished serving a customer and came over to them. Her eyes were focused on Harry.
Hi, she said.
All Harry wanted to do was curl up on her lap and go to sleep.
2 double gin and tonics in the name of the law,
Andrew said.
I'd prefer a grapefruit juice, Harry said.
She served them and leaned across the bar.
Thanks for yesterday,
she whispered in Swedish to Harry. In the mirror behind her, he saw himself sitting with an idiotic grin on his face.
Hey, hey, no Scandinavian turtle doving here now, thank you very much. If I'm paying for the drinks, we speak in English.
Andrew shot them a stern look. And now I'll tell you young ones something. Love is a greater mystery than death. He paused for dramatic effect. Uncle Andrew's going to tell you about an ancient Australian legend, to wit, the story of the giant snake Berber and Waller. They bunched up closer, and Andrew licked his lips with relish as he lit a cigar.
Once upon a time, there was a young warrior called Waller, who had fallen in love with a beautiful young woman called Mura, and she with him. Waller had successfully completed his tribe's initiation rites. He was a man, and could therefore marry whichever of the tribe's women he liked, provided he had not been married before and she wanted him. And Mura did. Waller could hardly tear himself away from his beloved, but the tradition was that he had to go on a hunting expedition from which the spoils would be a kind of dowry for the bride's parents. Then the wedding could take place. One fine morning, the dew glistening on the leaves, Waller set out. Mura gave him a white cockatoo feather, which he wore in his hair. While Waller was away, Mura went out to collect honey for the feast. However, it was not so easy to find, and she had to go further from the camp than she was wont to do. She came to a valley with huge rocks. A strange silence hung over the valley. There was not a bird or an insect to be heard. She was about to leave when she spotted a nest with some big white eggs, the biggest she had ever seen. I'll take them to the feast, she thought, and stretched out a hand. At that moment, she heard something slither over the rocks, and before she had time to run or open her mouth, an enormous yellow and brown snake coiled itself around her waist. She fought, but could not free herself, and the snake was beginning to exert pressure. Mura looked up at the blue sky above the valley and tried to call Waller's name, but she did not have enough air in her lungs to utter a sound. The snake's grip tightened, and in the end all the life was squeezed out of Mura, and all the bones in her body were crushed. Then the snake slithered back into the shadows it had come from, where it was impossible to see it, because the colours merged with the light-dappled trees and rocks of the valley. 2 days passed before they found her crushed body among the rocks. Her parents were inconsolable, and her mother wept and asked her husband what they would say to Waller when he returned home. Andrew gazed at Harry and Birgitta through shiny eyes. The campfire was no more than embers when Waller returned from hunting the following dawn. Even though it had been a strenuous trek, his steps were light and his eyes bright and happy. He went to Moore's parents, who were sitting mute by the fire. "Here are my gifts to you," he said, and he had brought back a good catch, a kangaroo, a wombat, and emu thighs. "You've arrived in time for the funeral, Waller, you who would have been our son," Moore's father said. Waller looked as if he had been slapped and could barely conceal his pain and grief, but being the hardy warrior he was, he restrained the tears and asked coldly, "Why have you not already buried her?" "Because we didn't find her until today," the father said. "Then I'll accompany her and demand her spirit. Our Wirinun can heal her broken bones. Then I will return her spirit and breathe life into her." "It's too late," said the father. "Her spirit has already left to go where all women's spirits go, but her killer is still alive. Do you know your duty, my son?" Waller departed without a word. He lived in a cave with the other unmarried men of the tribe. He did not speak to them either. 7 months passed. Waller sat on his own and refused to take part in the singing and dancing. Some thought he had been hardening his heart to try and forget Mura. Others thought he was planning to follow Mura to the women's kingdom of death. "He will not succeed," they said. "There is one place for women and one for men."
A woman came to the fire and sat down. "You're wrong," she said. "He's deep in thought, planning how he can avenge the death of his woman. Do you suppose all you have to do is grab a spear and kill Boo Boo, the great yellow and brown snake? You've never seen it, but I saw it once when I was young, and that was the day my hair turned grey. It was the most frightening sight imaginable. Mark my words, Boo Boo can only be defeated in one way, and that is with bravery and cunning. And I think this young warrior has those attributes." The next day, Waller went to the fire. His eyes gleamed, and he seemed almost excited as he asked who wanted to accompany him to collect rubber. "We have rubber," they said, surprised to note Waller's good mood. "You can have some of ours." "I want fresh rubber," he said. He laughed at their startled faces and said, "Join me and I'll show you what I'm going to use it for." Curious, they joined him, and after they had collected the rubber, he led them to the valley with the huge rocks. There he built a platform in the highest tree and told the others to retreat to the valley entrance. With his best friend, he climbed the tree, and from there they shouted Berber's name as the echoes rang through the valley and the sun rose in the sky. Then it appeared, an enormous yellow and brown head swinging to and fro, searching for the source of the sound. Around it, a teeming mass of small yellow and brown snakes, obviously hatched from the eggs Moora had seen. Waller and his friend kneaded the rubber into small balls. When Berber saw them in the tree, it opened its jaws, flicked out its tongue and stretched up for them. The sun was now at its zenith, and Berber's red and white jaws glistened. As Berber launched its attack, Waller hurled the largest ball of rubber down the snake's open mouth, and instinctively it sank its fangs into it. Berber rolled around on the ground, but was unable to get rid of the rubber stuck in its mouth. Waller and his friend managed to perform the same trick with the smaller snakes, and soon they were rendered harmless with their jaws sealed. Then Waller called the other men, and they showed no mercy. All the snakes were killed. After all, Berber had killed the tribe's most beautiful daughter, and Berber's progeny would one day grow up to be as big as their mother. From that day forward, the feared yellow and brown Berber snake has been a rarity in Australia. But our fear of it has made it longer and fatter for every year that has passed. Andrew drained the last of his gin and tonic. "And tomorrow is?" Birgitta asked. "Love is a greater mystery than death, and you have to watch out for snakes." Andrew paid for the drinks, gave Harry a pat of encouragement, and left. Moora. 14. A dressing gown. He opened his eyes. The city outside his window droned and growled as it woke up, and the curtain waved lazily at him. He lay looking at an absurdity hanging on the wall on the other side of the spacious room, a picture of the Swedish royal couple. The queen with her calm, secure smile, and the king looking like someone was holding a knife to his back. Harry knew how he felt. He had himself been persuaded to play the title role in The Frog Prince at primary school. From somewhere came the sound of running water, and Harry rolled over onto the other side of the bed to smell her pillow. A jellyfish tentacle, or was it a long red hair, lay on the sheet. He was reminded of a headline on Dagbladet's sports page. Erland Jonsson, Moss FC, famous for his red hair and long balls. He considered how he felt. Light. As light as a feather, in fact. So light, he was afraid the fluttering curtains would lift him out of bed and whistle him through the window where he would float over Sydney in the rush hour and discover that he wasn't wearing any clothes. He concluded that the lightness was due to draining himself of various bodily fluids in the night, with such a vengeance that he must have lost several kilos in weight. Harry Hole, Oslo Police Station, famous for his weird ideas and empty balls, he muttered. "Pardon?" came a voice in Swedish. Birgitta was standing in the room in an unusually hideous dressing gown with a white towel wrapped around her head like a turban. "Oh, good morning, thou ancient, thou free and mountainous north, thou quiet, thou joyful beauty, I greet thee. I was just looking at the picture of the rebel king on the wall over there. Do you think he would rather have been a farmer digging the soil?" "That's how it seems." She studied the picture.
We can't all find the right niche in life. What about you, then?
She plunked herself down on the bed beside him.
A serious question for so early in the morning. Before I answer, I demand you remove that dressing gown. Without wishing to appear in any way negative, I think as a spontaneous reaction, your dressing gown qualifies for inclusion in my top 10 ugliest garment I've ever seen list. Brigitte laughed. I call it a passion killer. It performs a useful function when pig-headed strangers become too brash. Have you checked to see if that color has a name? Perhaps you're sitting on some unknown tint, a kind of undiscovered gap on the palette, somewhere between green and brown? Don't try and talk your way out of answering my question, you stubborn Norwegian buck. She hit him over the head with a pillow, but after a brief wrestling match, she ended up underneath. Harry held her hands tight while bending and trying to open her dressing gown belt with his mouth. Birgitta screamed when she realized what he was up to and freed a knee, which she planted firmly on his chin. Harry groaned and rolled over onto his side. In a flash, she placed her knees on his arms and sat on him. Answer me. All right, I give in. Yes, I've found my niche in life. I'm the best copper you can imagine. Yes, I would rather catch bad boys than dig the soil, or go to gala dinners and stand on a balcony waving to the masses. And yes, I know it's perverse.
Birgitta kissed him on the mouth.
You could have cleaned your teeth, Harry said through pinched lips. As she leaned back and laughed, Harry seized the opportunity. He lifted his head, grabbed the belt with his teeth, and pulled. The dressing gown slipped open and he rolled her over. Her skin was hot and moist from the shower.
Police! She screamed, wrapping her legs around him.
Harry felt his pulse pounding right through his body.
Help! She whispered, and nibbled his ear.
Afterward, they lay gazing at the ceiling.
I wish...
Birgitta began.
Yes? Oh, nothing.
They got up and dressed. Harry saw from his watch that he was already late for the morning meeting. He stood by the front door with his arms around her.
I think I know what you wish, Harry said. You wish I would tell you something about myself.
Birgitta rested her head against his neck.
I know you don't like doing it, she said. I have a feeling that anything I know about you, I've had to force out of you. Your mother was a kind, clever woman, half Sami, and you miss her. Your father's a teacher and doesn't like what you're doing but doesn't say so. And the person you love above all else on earth, your sister, has a touch of Down syndrome. I like to know this sort of thing about you, but I want you to tell me things because you want to tell me them.
Harry stroked her neck. Do you want to know something real? A secret? She nodded. Sharing secrets binds people together, though, Harry whispered into her hair, and that's not always what people want. They stood in the hall without speaking. Harry took a deep breath. All my life I've been surrounded by people who love me. I've been given everything I asked for. In short, I have no explanation for why I've turned out as I have. A puff of wind brushed Harry's hair, so gently that he had to close his eyes. Why I have become an alcoholic. He said it with brutal harshness. Birgitta clung to him without moving.
It takes quite a bit for a civil servant in Norway to be given the boot. Incompetence is not enough. Laziness is a non-concept, and you can abuse your boss as much as you like, no problem. To tell the truth, you can do just about anything. Legislation protects you against most things, except for drinking. If you turn up for work in an inebriated state more than twice in the police force, that's grounds for immediate dismissal. For a time there, it was easier to count the days I wasn't drunk. He relaxed his grip and held her in front of him. He wanted to see how she was reacting. Then he drew her into him again. Nevertheless, I got by somehow, and those who guessed what was going on turned a blind eye. Someone should have reported me, but loyalty and solidarity are strong in the police. One evening, a colleague and I were going to a flat on Holmenkollen Ridge to interview a guy about a drugs murder. He wasn't even a suspect, but while we were outside ringing the doorbell, we saw his car come steaming out of the garage, and we jumped in ours and gave chase. We put the blue light on the roof, and were doing 110 kilometers per hour down Circa Dalsveien. The road curved left and right. We hit a couple of curbs, and my colleague asked if he shouldn't take over at the wheel. I was so intent on catching our man that I just dismissed the suggestion. What happened later he only knew from reports. In Vinderen, a car had pulled out from the petrol station, driven by a young boy who had just passed his test and gone to the garage to buy cigarettes for his father. The two policemen shunted his car through the fence onto the train lines, dragging the bus shelter where, 2 minutes earlier, five or six people had been standing, and came to a halt on the platform on the other side of the rails. Harry's colleague was hurled through the windscreen and found 20 meters further down the line. He had struck a fence post, head first. The force had been so great, the post was bent at the top. They had had to take fingerprints to be absolutely sure of his identity. The boy in the other car was paralyzed from the neck down. "I went to visit him in a place called Sunas," Harry said. "He's still dreaming about driving a car again one day. They found me in the wreckage with a cracked skull and internal bleeding. I was on life support for several days." His father had visited him every day with his sister. They had sat on either side of the bed holding his hand. Because serious concussion had disturbed his vision, he wasn't allowed to read or watch TV. So his father had read to him, sat close to the bed, and whispered in his ear so as not to wear him out, while reading from Sigurd Hoel and Kjartan Flugstad, his father's favorite authors. I had killed a man and destroyed someone else's life. Yet I was lying cocooned in love and attentive devotion. And the first thing I did when I was moved to a ward was bribe the man in the next bed to get his brother to buy me a bottle of whiskey. Harry paused. Birgitta's breathing was calm and even. "Are you shocked?" he asked. "I knew you were an alcoholic the first moment I saw you," Birgitta answered. "My father's one." Harry didn't know what to say. "Tell me more," she said. The rest is about the Norwegian police. Perhaps it's better not to know." "We're a long way from Norway now," she said. Harry gave her a quick squeeze. "You've heard enough for one day," he said. "To be continued in the next issue. I must be off. Is it all right if I come to the Albury and get under your feet tonight as well?" Birgitta smiled a sad smile, and Harry knew he was getting more involved than he should. 15. Statistical Significance. "You're late," Watkins stated as Harry arrived in the office. He placed a set of photocopies on his desk. "Jet lag. Anything new?" Harry asked. "You've got a bit of reading here. Yongsway's dug up some old rape cases. He and Kensington are having a bow peep right now." Yong laid a transparency on the overhead projector. "This year in Australia, more than 5,000 rapes have been reported. Obviously, trying to find a pattern from such a collection is hopeless without using statistics. Cold, concise statistics. Keyword number one is statistical significance. In other words, we're looking for a system that cannot be explained by statistical chance. Keyword number two is demography. I searched first for reports on unsolved murders and rapes over the last 5 years containing the words strangle or suffocate. I found 12 murders and a few hundred rapes. Next, I whittled down the number by adding that the victims should be blondes aged between 16 and 35 and living on the East Coast. Official statistics and data concerning hair colour released by the passport office show that this group constitutes less than 5% of the female population, yet I was left with 7 murders and over 40 rapes. Young placed another transparency on the overhead projector, showing percentages and a bar chart. He allowed the others to read without making any comment. A long silence followed. Watkins was the first to speak. "Does that mean..." "No," Young said. "It doesn't mean we know anything we didn't know before. The numbers are too vague."
"But we can imagine," Andrew said. "We can, for example, imagine that there is a person out there raping blonde women systematically and killing them a little less systematically, and who likes putting his hands round a woman's throat." Suddenly everyone started speaking at once, and Watkins held up his hands for silence. Harry was the first to speak up. "Why hasn't this connection been discovered before? We're talking about 7 murders and 40 to 50 rapes with a possible link here." Yong Sui shrugged. "Rape is unfortunately an everyday event in Australia as well, and perhaps it isn't given the priority you think it should be given." Harry nodded.
He felt no cause to swell his chest with pride on Norway's account. Furthermore, most rapists find their victims in the town or region where they live, and they don't flee the area afterward. That's why there's no systematic collaboration between the various states in standard rape cases. The problem in the cases that form my statistics is the geographical spread. Young pointed to the list of place names and dates. One day in Melbourne, a month later in Cairns, and the week after in Newcastle. Rapes in three different states in under 2 months. Sometimes wearing a balaclava, sometimes a mask, at least once a nylon stocking, and a few times the women haven't seen the rapist at all. The crime scenes are everything from dark back streets to parks. The victims have been dragged into cars or their homes have been broken into at night. In summary, there is no pattern here except that the victims are blonde, have been strangled, and no one has been able to give the police a description of the men. Well, there is one other thing. When he carries out the murder, he's extremely clean, alas. He probably washes the victims, removes any traces of himself, fingerprints, semen, clothing fibres, hair, skin under the victim's nails, and so on. But apart from that, there are none of the things we generally associate with a serial killer. No signs of grotesque ritual acts or calling cards for the police saying, "I was here." After the three rapes in 2 months, it's been quiet for a whole year. Unless he's behind some of the other rapes reported. But we can't know that. "What about the killings?" Harry asked. "Shouldn't that have rung some bells?" Yong shook his head. "As I said, geographical spread. If the Brisbane police find a body that has been sexually abused, Sydney's not the first place they'll look. Anyway, the murders are spread over so much time, it would be difficult for anyone to see a clear connection. After all, strangulation isn't unusual in rape cases." "Don't you have a fully functional federal police force in Australia?" Harry asked. Smiles all round the table. Harry changed the subject. "If it's a serial killer," Harry started, "then he often has a pattern, a theme," Andrew finished. "But there isn't one here, is there?" Yong shook his head. "Some officer at some point over the years must have considered the idea that a serial killer was on the loose. He probably took out old files from the archives and compared them, but the variations have been too wide to support the suspicion." "If it is a serial killer, wouldn't he have a more or less conscious desire to be caught?" Lebby asked. Watkins cleared his throat. This was his special area. "That's the way it's presented in crime fiction," he said. "The murderer's actions are a cry for help. He leaves small coded messages and evidence as the result of an unconscious desire for someone to stop him killing. And sometimes that is how it is. But unfortunately, most serial killers are like most people. They don't want to be caught. And if this really is a serial killer, he hasn't given us much to go on. There are a number of things I don't like." He scrunched up his face and revealed a top set of yellow teeth. "First of all, there doesn't seem to be any pattern to the killings, apart from the fact that the victims are blondes and he throttles them. That might suggest he views murders as isolated events, like a piece of art that has to be different from what went before, or there's an underlying pattern here we can't see yet. But it could also mean the murders are unplanned. So in some cases it becomes a necessity, for example, if the victim has seen his face, resisted, screamed for help, or something unforeseen has happened. Perhaps he only murdered when he couldn't get it up," Lebby suggested. "Perhaps we ought to let some psychologists have a closer look at these cases," Harry said. "They might be able to come up with a profile that could help us." "Perhaps," Watkins said. He seemed to have his mind on other matters. "What's second of all, sir?" Yong asked. "What?" Watkins was back. "You said, first of all, what's the second thing you don't like?" "His sudden inactivity," Watkins said. "Of course, that may be for purely practical reasons, like he's travelling or he's ill. But it could also be because he's got a feeling someone's going to suspect a link somewhere. So he stops for a while. Just like that." He snapped his fingers. "In which case, we've got a really dangerous man on our hands. One who's disciplined and cunning and isn't driven by the kind of self-destructive passion that can only escalate and in the end betray most serial killers. A smart, calculating murderer whom we're unlikely to catch until he's unleashed a veritable bloodbath. If we ever do." "What do we do now?" Andrew asked. "Do we tell all blondes under pensionable age to stay at home in the evenings?" "Doing that would make him go underground, and we'd never find him then," Lebby said. He had taken out a penknife and was painstakingly cleaning his nails.
On the other hand, are we going to leave all the blondes in Australia to their doom as bait for this black?
Young said. There's no point telling women to stay indoors, Watkins said. If he's on the prowl for a victim, he'll find one. He broke into a couple of houses, didn't he? Forget it. We'll have to smoke him out.
How, though? He operates right across the bloody country, and no one knows when he'll strike next. The guy rapes and kills at random.
Levy was talking to his nails. That's not correct, Andrew answered. To have survived for so long, there's nothing random about it. There is a pattern. There's always a pattern. Not because you plan it, but because all humans are creatures of habit. There's no difference between you and me and the rapist. It's just a question of finding what this particular creature's habits are.
The man's out of his mind, Levy said. Aren't all serial killers schizophrenic anyway? Don't they hear voices telling them to kill?
I agree with Harry. Let's get a shrink in.
Watkins was scratching his neck. He seemed bemused.
A psychologist can probably tell us a lot about a serial killer, but it's not at all certain that that's what we're after here,
Andrew said.
Seven murders. I called that serial killing, Levy said.
Listen, Andrew said, leaning over the table and holding up his big black hands. For a serial killer, the sexual act comes second to killing. Raping without killing has no meaning. But for our man, raping is paramount. In cases where he kills, there is consequently a practical reason, as Inspector Watkins says. Perhaps the victim can expose him. She's seen his face.
Andrew paused. Or they know who he is. He placed his hands down in front of him. The fan was creaking away in the corner, but the air was stuffier than ever.
Statistics are all well and good, Harry said, but we mustn't let ourselves get carried away. Ingeholter's murder may be an isolated act. Some people died of common pneumonia during the Black Death, didn't they? Let's assume that Evans White is not a serial killer. The fact that there's another guy running round killing blondes doesn't mean that Evans White can't have taken the life of Ingeholter.
Complicated explanation, but I take your point, Howley, Watkins said and summed up.
Okay, folks, we're looking for a rapist and a possible, I repeat, possible serial killer. I'll leave it to McCormick to decide whether to ramp up the investigation. In the meantime, we'll have to continue what we're doing now. Kensington, anything new to report?
Howley didn't make the morning meeting, so for his sake I'll repeat myself. I spoke to Robertson, Ingeholter's wonderful landlord, and asked him if the name Evans White rang any bells. And the fog must have lifted temporarily, because in fact the name did. We're going over this afternoon. Otherwise, the sheriff of Nimbin rang. This Angelina Hutchinson confirmed that she'd been at Evans White's house for the 2 nights before Ingeholter was found.
Harry swore.
Watkins clapped his hands. Okay, back to work, boys. Let's nail this bastard.
The words came without much conviction.